Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this edition of the War Report. Like last week, we have a lot to try and cover and try and move us to a particular point by the end of this session. Recall that I want to do this as a three-part series. And I said last time that think of what took place last week as me taking a funnel and inverting it, turning it upside down so that the beacon is up, and started dropping ideas, comments, information in that open end and putting in a lot of stuff that hopefully will flow through. And as it goes through the funnel and comes out the other end, you and I will have been able to establish a framework for talking about how neoliberalism impacts public education and the public ed community. That's where we're hoping to arrive. But in order to get there, there are a lot that we have to cover in order to be able to have that endpoint understandable and appreciated. Today, to start off with, one of the biggest things that if I said it last week, and by the way, I did go back and listen to the show from last week to see what I did and how I did it, and I rated myself. Yes, accountability measures, my own VAM. And I had to play Cuomo and start adjusting the cutoff rates in order to be able to get to a C. So I'm going to try and fill in some of those gaps from last week so that by the end of this show, we'll be where we should be, and hopefully the gaps will be gone. One thing I want to say that permeates everything that I have said and will say, think about this. I've said that the neoliberal movement, I'll call it a movement for now, is global. It's damn near everywhere. It's massive. And almost everywhere it has been adopted and applied, it has been destructive. That's one thing. But what I really want you to get is neoliberalism has been around in the form that we're talking about since, depending on where you want to start, the 70s, and bringing it up today, we're talking 30, 35 years. Repeat, 30 to 35 years. This ideology, this set of beliefs, practices, and et cetera, has almost dominated the world in 35 years. I'm going to pause for a second. I want that to sink in. By comparison, let's take Christianity, that social institution I talked about last time, religion, that all societies have some form of religion that's institutionalized. Take Christianity. What are we talking about? 2,000 years plus? And its ideal was to spread Christianity around or through the known world. And here we're talking 2,000 plus years, and has not been able to do that. it was prepared to take on other religious philosophies to the point where, remember the Crusade, where Europe took on the Middle East in terms of attempts to spread Christianity? Compare that again to neoliberalism. 30 to 35 years. I know I'm repeating myself, but that is beyond phenomenal. How quickly this ideology took off and engulfed the planet. And yes, it does have complications, impact on all of humanity, the 7 billion plus of us, as well this planet that we live on and supposedly share. Okay, wanted to get that out of the way, because I will allude to it again and again, and I hope I've gotten you awakened to the point where you get that. Now, I left off last week, and I was talking about the 1970s. I recall that I started, and I mentioned Lewis Powell. He was a guy who was just about ready to be placed on the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, but he had a particular set of concerns. Having gone through the 60s, he said something to the, he wrote a memo, a secret confidential memo, and he sent it to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in August of 1971. This was before he was elevated to the Supreme Court. He argued that criticism and opposition to the U.S. commerce community, the enterprise, business, and et cetera, had gotten so far out of hand by the liberals, the moderates, the women, men, black, white, young, old, etc., that this was disturbing to him, this was frightening to him. And in his memo, he basically told the people that he sent it to, that the National Chamber of Commerce, that we have to stop. I don't say we because I definitely wasn't a part of that and you weren't either, but I use the term we have to stop this assault on us. And he identified us as being the business class, that 1% that you've heard me talk about going back to the close of the Revolutionary War, when John Jay said that the purpose of this new government that we were trying to form should be that those who own the country ought to govern the country. I see what Powell was saying as a fantastic example of that idea that has been around since the 1700s. And in his memo, basically what he was saying is that we need to reestablish our importance, our power, and our control, because we're in the process of losing it. And that in order to do this, we being the business community, we have to stop thinking and acting as individuals, and instead we must come together, unify, create a unified message, a unified organizational structure, and then go out and take on the masses. I'm reducing it down to these terms. And his notion was that individually we can achieve X, but collectively we could do X, Y, and Z. And it's only until we become unified and one voice, not competing among ourselves for market share or for supremacy, but competing as a single unit, will we be able to try and stem this tide of rising opposition to the business class? Remember this, the business class, because what he was talking about is class warfare. Think about the French Revolution as the primary example of class warfare for the last, 300 years or so, whereby the nobility was dethroned, some of them lost their head, by the peasant class. He was, I think, looking at the situation here in the U.S. through similar lenses. And so that's a starting point. This is early 70s. Also, remember this. The 1970s, I believe, and I think many others do too, will go down possibly, and I'm laughing to myself, possibly as the decade of infamy, using Franklin Delano Roosevelt when he said December 7th, a day of infamy. And what I'm saying, and of course now that's a bias, but what I'm saying is it is during the 70s that neoliberalism as we know it, as we have experienced it, and we are currently living it, really got its start. The tsunami that started was in the 70s, and by the end of the 70s, 79, and then 80s, and going forward, it has conquered almost the world. Repeating myself, it has almost conquered the world. So that's the decade we're going to talk about to some extent, and then we're going to move on. During the 70s, in addition to Powell telling the business class they needed to come together and organize and prepare to take on the masses, certain things happened during that particular 10-year period. One was coming to the realization of how do we do this? How do we organize and to the point where we will have the strength? We have the money, but we need more than just money to pull this off. And it was realized and or decided or however they arrived at it that three things had to happen. They needed, one, a political class. They were the business class. They're small, numerically. Wealthy, powerful financially, but small numerically. They needed to get a political class. And what they did was, they looked over the landscape and said, the Democrats, no. Democrats cater to the working, the poor. That's where they get their strength from, and that's the group that potentially, if they ever organize collectively, could threaten us. They look at the Republicans, because we only have two parties here in this country, really, Republican and Democrat, and they said the Republicans was the way to go. If they could take the Republicans and sell them on, and I'm generalizing, folks, because that's the only thing I can do at this point. But and I'm imagining to some extent the conversation, da 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 da. But these things happened. They were able to get the Republican Party to buy in to their philosophy. It was easy. Republicans were already buying into the philosophy of it's the business class that should have preference, priority, and power in the society. It has always been there. So this was probably a very easy sell. And so they set about, and they were able to bring in the Republican Party as the second element of what they needed in order to accomplish their mission of regaining power and control of American society and all of its institutions. Thirdly, the Republicans, they are the minority party throughout almost most of its existence. There have been more Democrats or registered Democrats or people voting Democratically or Democratic Party than Republican. So they needed a third something. And that third something turned out to be they wanted a religious class. I'm going to use the term a religious class. They wanted a religious class that would bring its numbers, it would bring its commitment of its members, and they would bring mostly the numbers that were needed to be able to swing national election, local or state election, like the governor, and then city election to their point of view. Now, again, let me sort of like repeat, because this is huge. One, this is a plan. This is not accidental. This is thought out, analyzed, bringing the best people that money can buy to put together this plan. And then once the plan was put together, analyzing and deciding what they needed in order to put this plan in position to have the best opportunity of succeeding. Now, let me fast forward to 2000, 2001, 2, and on. I have said repeatedly that the war on public education was a planned agenda, and that the people who planned this, you have to take your hats off to them. They're very, very good. They're bright. They knew exactly what they were doing. They studied history, and particularly the civil rights movement, how that movement was able to come across and be so successful. None of this is what's happening to public education is an accident or byproduct of something else. My argument is that what is happening to us is happening according to a plan, similar to the plan of 1971 going forward that launched where we are today, the neoliberal movement. That's why I wanted you to be able to understand where I'm going by taking this close look at the 70s, because it set the stage, the framework for everything that would happen through the 80s and 90s, the 2000s, and now into the teens. It's planned, systematic unfolding of an agenda. Okay. Now, we have the corporations, the business class, we have the Republican Party. Oh, and I'll add too, in the late 90s and going forward, you can add the Democratic Party to this mix with Clinton and the Third Way and Obama with continuation of the Third Way. So you have everything coming together and working, and it's the 35 years that I mentioned earlier. This is all part of what took place in that 35-year period. Phenomenal, folks. How fast this all has happened. I'll say it a million times. It blows my mind how fast they were able to pull together. They had a damn good plan, obviously, and they pulled it off to perfection. Okay. Now, some of the things that happened during the 70s, we're sort of like in the middle of this funnel now, and bring it down a little bit more specifically to our end game of understanding how all of this affects public education and the public ed community. In the 70s, we had financial crisis. And as a result of the financial crisis, the stock market tumbling, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know how many of you were around and old enough to recall some of the things I'm about to say about the 70s. But we saw in the 70s, big corporations, and IBM in particular comes to mind, were impacted by the financial crisis of the 70s. So much so that IBM, the bedrock of the blue chip stock market stock, you always had IBM in your portfolio. IBM in the 70s announced that it was laying off 100,000 employees. And they used, I think the word downsizing was the word that was used and came into our vocabulary. I remember this vividly. By the mid-70s, I was, you know, the professor at UCLA. I had some friends who were working at IBM, a couple, the young lady in that couple, I had met in my sophomore year when I first came out to California, and we rode the bus together to L.A. City College. And she used to tell me, she was from Mississippi, she used to tell me that she was in college to, one, find a husband and to get an education, but she wanted to meet and hook up with someone from, I think it was Alpha Kappa Delta fraternity. Why? Because those guys were the guys who made it in the business world, and that's where she wanted to go. Well, she did. She met a guy, they got married, and they both ended up working for IBM. And by the middle of the 70s, they were both in high management positions, pulling down almost six-figure jobs. They were doing it, and in their 30s. When IBM announced that it was going to have to downsize and get rid of 100,000 employees. These were white-collar positions, folks. White-collar, not your blue-collar and not your low-level employee classification. We're talking middle-class, white-collar jobs that were going to be lost. This was just one of many areas that the economy started to experience crises. And in the urban centers, New York, Detroit, Los Angeles, Chicago, Philadelphia, you add to that the crisis that was taking place in the industrial base of this country, what we now call the Rust Belt, because they have almost disappeared. The automobile industry, all kinds of industries that built machinery and appliances and et cetera were being affected by this financial crisis. And it was New York that I want to bring our attention to. New York was hit really, really hard in the 70s. So much so, it was almost like Greece is today. It was facing the inability to meet its debt service to the large financial institution that floated huge credit lines to New York and also bought up a kajillion number of shares of bonds that the city had floated over the years. And so we have, going into the 70s, Powell telling the business community what it needed to do, the business community bringing in the Republican Party, and then bringing in, they brought in, remember the Moral Majority, Farwell, Jerry Farwell's organization? That was the third leg here of this triumphant. And it was that group that got Richard Nixon elected, proving that the strategy was working, the agenda was working. Nixon, when he got in, what he said was, there is no more crises. Crisis is over. The government will no longer pump in billions, tens of billions of dollars to states and cities to help deal with the crisis that no longer exists. You're on your own. It was a lie of gigantic proportion, but that was part of the strategy. No crisis, no government bailout. You're on your own. This left New York City, and I'm picking out New York because it was really an epic center of where we are today. Left New York in big, big trouble. The financial community says that we're not going to bail you out by giving you more money, and we want you to make your debt service payment on time. New York was in a bind. It was either going to have to declare bankruptcy or end up going into big-time litigation with the financial institutions that had provided billions of dollars that they couldn't repay back or couldn't pay back on a timely basis. Also, New York, like many of the urban centers, they were losing their middle-class jobs, and the middle-class people were moving out of the city, leaving in the city your poor, your indigent, your blue-collar, people who could not pay taxes at a high enough level that New York could have the money to support itself and pay back its debt. It was bad times for New York, folks. Now, the financial community was approached by New York to negotiate, to work out something just like what was happening in Greece today. And the financial community said, no, no deal. We're not going to extend you more credit, and we insist that you pay us now. Whatever tax revenue you are collecting, you pay us first, and then what's left, you can do with what you want in terms of your social programs. This stance was supported by the federal government in the form of the Secretary of Commerce was behind it. And we see the beginnings of the first blow of the neoliberal movement to use government. Remember I said last week, one of the things that the neoliberal believe is that government at all levels should be used as instruments to create a social structure, a culture that serves the business class interests. That's why the Republicans were chosen. And so what the government wanted and what the business class, the financial class wanted, was for New York to be able to pay up or pay the consequences. And here are the consequences. New York, big time, the Big Apple, experienced what Greece, Spain, many of the countries in Europe, and almost all the countries across Africa, and many of the countries across Asia, the smaller countries, are experiencing. New York was forced to develop or accept an austerity program. There's that word. It's really a four-letter word with more than four letters. An austerity program that would call for a restructuring or remaking of New York along the lines that were totally beneficial to the business, the corporate ownership class. And here you have one of the very first experiments of neoliberalism and the remaking of the image of humanity or man, the image of society, and the relationship between man and society. Let me stop for a second and go back to something that I also said last week. I mentioned that when I was teaching the university, in my intro to social psychology, which was for junior, seniors, and graduate students, I laid out what is the paradigm, the big picture issues that my discipline focused upon. And there were five of them. First was our image of man. What is the nature of man from conception to death? Is man an aggressive beast? Is man a kind, caring by nature? Or is something in between? What is society, the image of society? What makes a society a society? What's the function of society? And then the relationship between man and his society. Then the two other important big picture issues or questions were, why do people do what they do? What is the motivation? The word motivation comes into play here. What motivates us? What drives us to do the things that we do? And then the last point was behavior. How and why do we change our behavior? What causes us to change? And the recognition that changing behavior is one of the hardest things in the world to do. Those are the five big issues. Neoliberalism, as I'm going to call it a philosophy, its view or image of man is that of the economic man, that we are born to be economically driven. Our motivation is economically driven. Our society comes together with all the various individuals coming together and forming a huge collective group, is driven by economic. Behavior change is driven by economics. And in the field of economics, I'm referring to what one of the major theories is that of the economic man. And that's how they explain all of human behavior, society, et cetera, is through the prism of the economic man. So that here, neoliberalism, as I also mentioned, started off with Adam Smith, but in the 1900s and the 1930s and 40s and 50s and into the 60s and 70s, Adam Smith's version of capitalism was reinvented to where we are today in terms of neoliberalism. Adam Smith probably wouldn't even recognize his ideas, his philosophy today. That's how much they have changed. And bringing that whole model of the image of man, society, motivation, and change together, you see that neoliberalism as a philosophy is all-encompassing, but it is hugely powerful in its ability to bring about a government that fits its image, a humanity that fits its image, a collective society globally that fits its image, and to do all of this and change human behavior, both at the psychological, the values, the attitudes, the beliefs, and the behavioral level in 35 years. Folks, as a social scientist, this blows my mind. This is truly awesome. And we apply it to education, as you, some of us are able to do, and can see these dots and start connecting these dots and applying it to education, both as a result of you being a teacher or a parent or a concerned supporter of public education. You can begin to already see where I'm heading when we come out the end of this funnel and start applying all this to education. Again, very quick, bastardized history. But New York was a prominent player in the 70s. It set the table. Let me go back to New York again. This austerity program, New York had to do a lot of the things that we see happening in Greece and we see now happening all across the U.S. They had to sell off some of their assets, land. They had to, I think, deal with the rail system, the famous New York transit system. And they had to deal with the unions. They had to defang the unions, reduce the unions' influence and power. And also, the unions themselves were attacked by saying to the unions, which is what Rahm Emanuel is saying to the unions in Chicago now, just this past couple of weeks. They have to say to the unions that you have to take this huge chest of money that you have and that you've collected from your members over the years, that in the billions of dollars, you have to start buying city bonds, the bonds that the financial community were floating for New York. In other words, unions, you have to help bail out the city from its crisis, a crisis that you helped make with your high demands for your workers, the package of health care, retirement, work, short work days, X number of days, vacation during the summer, off on holidays, and et cetera. All these things that you have been able to negotiate for your members while you were collecting their dues, you now need to put that money on the table to help the city get out of its financial crisis. It was the austerity package that has been emulated across the U.S. and now Europe and now Asia and Africa. It's basically a robbing of the 99% to pay the 1%. that model comes out of the New York experience of the 70s. Moving further into the 70s, 1977, China announced that it was going to revolutionize its economic institution. It was going to remove the state to some extent and start promoting individual entrepreneurship, government supporting big business, and creating this goal of a 10%, I think it was 10% a year growth rate. Unheard of, unimaginable, but that's what they were going to do. 77. 78, Margaret Thatcher, I think it was 78, it could have been 79, but I'm going to say stick with 78. Margaret Thatcher in England becomes prime minister. She is a devotee to the infant neoliberalism that was coming out of America, coming out of University of Chicago to be particular. And she is in position. Ronald Reagan, well, let's stop before Reagan. In 79, Chile, you've heard me mention this time and time again, Chile, but I'll also add Argentina. They jump on the neoliberal bandwagon. They did it through a brutal military-style coup, taking over the government, and then beginning to implement neoliberal ideology. In both cases, in particular Chile, the military coup was put together by the elite in Chile who were being threatened, and the Chicago Boys, I mentioned them, a group of Chileans who left Chile, came to the United States, University of Chicago, and studied economics under Milton Friedman. And when they went back, they were pushing the neoliberal agenda. And a third party to this was the United States government in the form of the CIA, the new triumvirate that was able to overthrow the democratically elected president Allende and install the general Augusto Pinochet there, and in Chile, the same thing. It happened like almost overnight in Chile, this implementation of neoliberalism. In other countries where in Latin America, where the U.S. and others could engineer coups that would result in neoliberal devotees coming to power and implementing the neoliberal agenda. In the United States and other parts of Europe, the implementation of neoliberalism was much more gradual in nature than instantaneous as via a coup. And it was in the end of the 70s and the 1980s that in the U.S., Reagan, Margaret Thatcher in England, Xiaoping in China, and Augusto Pinochet in Chile form the four tentpoles necessary for this huge umbrella of neoliberalism to start to grow and to mushroom and take off, like, as I said before, unlike anything we have ever seen before. Now we're in the middle of this long journey that I've been trying to take us through over the 35 years. And what we have now going into the 80s was more politicians here in the United States, back here at home, more politicians becoming neoliberals. Neoconservatives, neoliberals, third way Democrats. We have the moral majority pushing the same principles and values, all being manipulated by the original, the business class. And we have now in America becoming or beginning to assert itself and pushing the neoliberal agenda that would lead to, this is another end point that I want you to remember, America becoming an empire, like the British Empire, and before it, the Roman Empire. And before all of that, well, probably simultaneously with all of that, in Asia, Genghis Khan establishing an empire. And before that, Alexander the Great establishing an empire. Alexander did it before he was 32, or by he turned 32, he had conquered and brought under the governance of Greece the known world as it was known at that time. So we have, coming out of the 70s into the 80s, a change back to that paradigm of social change, individual change, America becoming or begin to see itself and asserting itself as an empire. First through militarization, having won the war and having the military industrial complex that grew in that the war, World War II period, still intact and still churning along like gangbusters. We will now add to the military-industrial complex and the power that it gives us to have a military that is super well-equipped and large, able to go anywhere in the world and defend democracy and freedom. We add to that now the economic muscle that neoliberalism affords us. And we add to it the moral stance of the moral majority, the Christians' belief in the individual freedom, and that it's okay to spread this ideology. And so we sort of like now come to where we are in more modern times. We see how neoliberalism was a morphing from capitalism into a structure that is far beyond what Adam Smith and others had in mind. We see how the events of the 50s, the Supreme Court decision impacting separate but equal, overturning it, considered calling it unconstitutional, and that impact on education and the larger society. We see how coming into from the civil rights movement, coming into the 60s, an expansion of the movement to include the environmental groups, women, women's rights, and other groups, creating this huge, massive movement that a movement of that nature needs to be able to bring about the change that it desires. We see how, as I mentioned in the first session, the competition for dominance between the classes has always been there and been a concern. we see how individuals here in the U.S. are threatened by the 50s and the 60s on many different levels, and how they decide to come together in their own best interest, by the way, in their own best interest, and do something about it. And that something about it was, how do we regain control over our society and its people? We see how I think that was answered, with Powell being a hugely influential voice saying, we need to do this, and this is what we need to do. We see the business class agreeing and saying yes. And we see the birth of, in the 70s, the business roundtable. And then later, in the 90s and the 2000s, we see the birth of ALEX, the Legislative Exchange Commission, who writes model legislation for states and the federal government, and lobby for that legislation to be enacted that benefits the business class at all levels. All of this is coming out of the 70s, setting the stage for what would happen in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, now into the teens. And also for us, as it relates to public education, think about this. A nation at risk comes out of this movement. It's frontal attack on education. Further, 2001, 2002, No Child Left Behind. 2008, and all the way through to where we are now, Race to the Top. Think about also, we get the governors in the many states that push the neoliberal agenda. Think about the mayors, city council, county, if you have big county governments in your state. All of what we're seeing now, the groundwork was laid during the 70s, a reaction to the 60s, the 50s, the 40s, and back to the 30s when Roosevelt became president and started the New Deal. I hope I've done justice to this history, this journey for you, and I hope we'll be ready and able to apply all of this to what is dear to us, public education. So, my time is up. I think I brought us to the point where we can do part three next week, and people will understand and appreciate the journey up to and beyond where we take off next week and where we end. With that, I have to say goodbye. Time is up. And everyone have a great Sunday and come back next week.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.